Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 24th day of May, although the weather wouldn't tell you that. Anno Domini 2025, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, for your edification and delectation, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Have you paid your dues? Here comes the news.
Do you know where your towel is?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow's towel day, yeah.
Tomorrow's towel day.
Did you know that they're saying right now, you're talking about the rain and everything else, this has been one of the rainiest Mays on record.
Yep.
And
I believe it.
Yeah.
I've been wet more than once.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
No lie. It's like trying to figure out what days you might have off that you can get out and cut the grass because it's growing so darn fast. Right. It's unbelievable.
I want to replace my lawn with myrtle. It's a ground cover and it's low and it's green and it's pretty.
Oh yeah, it is.
It's what I want to do. All right. It's enough for Doc and Katie. Let's go back to computer stuff. Google I.O., Google's annual developer conference, was this week, and they announced quite literally 100 new things. All of them are aimed at dominating every aspect of AI. The biggest thing was something called AI mode for search, which is supposed to be a total overhaul of search. In AI mode, users will have a far more conversational search experience, asking Google questions directly about what they're looking for. While this certainly is nicer than wandering around through a massive horde of links to find what you want, Google could end up eating away at Google's cash cow, ads. Gemini, which is a whole family of AI products, was everywhere at I.O. Google announced that it will integrate Gemini into Chrome, allowing users to chat with its latest AI models while they browse, because, you know, we're not distracted enough while we're working. With an update called Personal Context, Gemini app users get tailored responses based on personal data from Google services, like asking its AI to find a long-lost email because Google's not already deep enough in our pockets or other parts of our body. Google also showed the next generation of Google Glass, which runs Android XR. They certainly look nicer than the original Google Glass. These look like regular glasses and are light years ahead of Apple's pound-and-a-half monstrosity. We'll see which of the 100 announcements matter to the general public, but one thing is certain. Google, like every other tech company on the planet, has gone all in on AI. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that would be bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Google I.O. Conference. And your choices are, I want everything. Some of it looks interesting. Stop with this AI nonsense. Meh. And of course, Goo what now? So far, we have 26 votes. 29 votes. This just in. And stop with this AI nonsense is just ahead of me. So, apparently people aren't as thrilled as they could be. Goo what now is next. And it isn't until the fourth thing down is some of it looks interesting. And nobody has voted for I want everything. Again, you can vote at the poll at soundbites.org. And, of course, if you have more to say on this or any other topic, you can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. The one thing I did kind of like was that Notebook LM is now available on the Android phones. Notebook LM is an AI product that's a little less annoying. AI, as we know, hallucinates, and will make up stuff.
Smoking some good stuff. It's
right.
Trained on lies, so it picked up that habit.
Yeah, exactly. Notebook LM, however, only talks about the things you've told it to talk about. So let's say I want to summarize a scientific paper. Thank you. Are we done already?
No.
That was great. Okay. We're not taking a break. We're just listening to the music.
I don't know where that came.
Very nice.
You said you liked upright bass, and so the...
I like a walking bass. I do.
Yeah, so the AI started playing it for you.
Started playing
That's scary.
I do like a walking bass.
My hands were over here, and that button over there.
Yeah, and you said that 3 weeks ago, and it finally caught up. So
finally caught up, yeah.
It must be running Internet Explorer.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So this Notebook LM, you feed it like a scientific paper, and it will then summarize that paper. It won't go out and find other topics. It won't look anywhere else. It just summarizes the things you give it. So if you give it peer-reviewed documents or properly vetted information, then it will only use that information. One cool thing about it that I also like, but it doesn't work on the mobile app yet, is that you can tell it to generate a podcast. So it generates two people talking about the thing you told it to talk about. Now, because some people are visual learners, some people are oral learners.
Mm-hmm.
They learn better by listening. And so you can listen to what is being said, and generally speaking, it summarizes the points and argues back and forth if you give it multiple documents that, you know, one says
points
A and one says B. It argues those points of view. It's really well done. And again, because it only works with the stuff you give it, it's a little more trustworthy.
Yeah, than just grabbing anything and everything off the internet.
Right. So that I liked. I very much liked that part. It also, you know, with a click of the button, you can generate FAQs and all sorts of stuff. So, and it takes PDFs and it takes you know, whatever documents you give it. So that impressed me. That particular product impressed me. Now, I haven't used it enough. It was just announced, just released.
Yeah,
I haven't used it enough to say it's great, but the idea
concept
impressed
is
me.
Good.
Yeah. But you know, we're getting AI in everything now, and I just read an article today about an AI that tried to rewrite its own code to escape the system.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we're at that level already. Skynet is a little late, but not by much. So we'll see. We'll see. It was an interesting I/O. The stuff that they announced, and we're going to get AI in everything, and that can be good. But
just like the internet, it's got its good stuff and it's got its bad. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. And it's going to be how it's used.
And we just have to be more aware of what it is we're seeing and more skeptical, quite frankly. We have to, you know, start taking everything with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Question
it all. Because
question everything.
Don't take everything, oh, well, it told me that it's this or that.
Yep.
Yeah. Treat it as an opinion.
Computers are not infallible.
In fact, the joke is they can make mistakes way faster than you can.
Way faster.
Oh, heck, yeah.
But apparently
to err as human, to really screw up, you need a computer.
Yeah. The upper management at Apple has finally acknowledged that the middle management at Apple's handling of AI and Siri features were crap.
They were crap.
Which is weird because they hired John Andrea from Google. Who was their AI guy? So maybe that's why Google let him go, because he wasn't any good.
Right.
So they're trying to reorganize the Siri division, and it had a nickname of being called Aimless. So AI is aimless. Yeah. But they kept demoing features that didn't exist yet. There were a lot of TV commercials touting features that didn't exist that have since been removed. There was fine print at the bottom of the commercial that said features coming soon.
Right.
And then it just said features coming.
Right.
Because they took
and
off.
And then it just said features.
And then they took it away completely. But there's already a class action suit that Apple advertised these features. And
well, all these ads say buy the iPhone 16 and get Apple Intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you get some of it, but not the coolest things they showed in the commercial.
Exactly. And the stuff they show in the commercial is what people want.
Yeah.
And that does not exist.
So now they're part of the thought on why Siri isn't as good as some of the other ones is that Apple is too focused on privacy. And so it doesn't know enough. And so there's a plan going. I'm not sure if this was a rumor or it's been made public yet. I'm still looking. That Apple is going to start a pilot program where it will ask if they can use your data as a learning platform for you. Because we all want our AI to, you know, did John answer that email yet?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it can't know that unless you give it permission to read your email.
Right.
Which is something Apple doesn't want to do, because that's a privacy issue.
Right. And that's what Notebook LM does.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the whole idea. This is my stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're giving it permission for your stuff.
Right. I explicitly entered it into the system.
Yep.
So it's okay for you to use it. And I get that. I do get that.
Their tag is your personal AI research assistant.
Right.
Your mm-hmm. research and thinking partner, grounded on information you trust.
Right. What, that's Notebook LM?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The promise of AI is, I think, entirely backwards. I don't need AI to create pictures for me. I need AI to wash the dishes so I can spend time creating pictures.
Yep.
That's what I want. But I will say I liked the idea of Google, the new Google glasses. I really did. They look like regular. They're a little thick frames. They're kind of Clark Kent glasses. You know, they're fairly thick framed compared to what people wear nowadays, like what you and I have.
Mm-hmm.
But they're, you know, they're just really regular glasses. And they project an image right on the inside of the lens, which is exactly
supposed to be. Heads up?
Yeah, it's a heads-up display. And it looks, you know, the Apple thing, I'm sorry, it looks like something out of a bad Russian science fiction movie. I'm sorry, but it does.
Well, they're trying to make it self-contained. There's rumors flying that there's going to be a slit. So I thought about this from the beginning. This is the Apple Vision Pro. That implies there's an Apple Vision non-pro.
Right.
So they take all the processing.
Or an Apple Vision anti.
Yeah. amateur.
You're right. Yeah.
They take all the processing out of the thing and put it in your phone, and you just tether it to your phone.
Well, and that's what Google Glass did.
Yeah.
But so, you know, the choice is a pound and a half on your face, which you're only going to wear for 10 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
Or a pair of glasses.
Yeah.
And it, you know.
I just want the implant already, darn it.
Well, exactly. The problem with all of these things is they don't do what I want to do.
Yeah.
What I want them to do is when I walk up to somebody, I want to see their name over their head, where I know them from, and why I know them.
Yeah, all the everybody.
There's a series of books from Daniel Suarez, I think it is, where everyone has implants, and that happens. And included in their name and family is their social media score.
Oh yeah.
So how active they are, if they have a positive or negative score, and that's just before the drones start killing you.
Well, yeah, I see that. Nice
talk. Talk about cool devices.
Yeah.
We had this one device come back to the store, and it's about as big as this table, and it was and I'm thinking, what the heck? $3,000.
Mesia.
And I go and look, a lawnmower.
Robot lawnmower.
Bingo.
Nice.
You could sit there and program the whole thing and use your phone to sit in the lawn chair and mow your lawn. Just like a huge indoor Zumba or...
Roomba, yeah.
Zumba, yeah.
Now, mowing the lawn on a riding mower is something I don't mind doing.
Right.
I just turn the music on. You zone out. Push mower, no.
Yeah, I used to use a push mower.
Yeah. the neighbors on both sides of us are both landscapers. And so on the one side, he'll mow my lawn up to the house so there's no seam on his yard. And he started to do the trim around the mailbox now.
Our neighbor, a very nice, very, 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 very nice man, mows our lawn once in a while. Very sweet. You know, both Elaine and I have had our physical issues recently, and it's very helpful.
Well,
plows our driveway too.
Well, that's the one advantage for me, you know, having the business residence, that I don't have a backyard. Well, I have a backyard, but it's all pavement.
Right.
To park cars for when I had the job. So the only lawn that I have is up front.
Yep.
Years ago, the guy across the street, catty-cornered us, took out his whole lawn and planted rocks, planted a rock garden. And the whole neighbor was like, R-r-r-r-r. I thought, that's brilliant.
Yep.
But you don't have to mow a rock garden.
I think
that is contraindicated, quite frankly.
I like your idea, though, of the ground cover.
I like the myrtle. It kills the grass, and it's a nice, even, small, green ground cover.
Because the grass...
lovely purple flowers.
The grass isn't a native species anyway.
That's exactly right. But
most of our backyard is still a swamp, we can't mow it. So we've let the little purple flowers come up.
Yeah, mine's getting so tall, you know, getting tall. I might lose one of my dogs.
Yeah.
Well, but your dogs you can lose them in a shag rug.
Yeah, no lie. But, you know, it's like, I can't get out there to mow, because if you do it, you're gonna wind up clogging it, you know, minute, take one sway, it's going to choke
it. That was the joy of a push mower. You could pretty much do that on anything. It didn't matter how, didn't matter what the weather was or what was going on. My father...
And you're old enough to have the mechanical one before there was a motor on it, right?
There was no motor.
Yeah.
There was no motor. I used a push mower, a regular...
Mm-hmm. Now, Grandpa had one of those, and it was fun for two or three strokes. And all right,
exactly. You
take over.
No, it was... again, you know, I was 10.
Yeah.
So...
Couldn't wait to mow the lawn.
I had the energy.
Yeah.
Right? So, again, I would zone out and just sit and think and mow, and it was very enjoyable. Very, very enjoyable. You all right there?
No.
Yeah, Dave is not all right, ladies and gentlemen. Dave is...
I've never been all right.
Well, that's true.
Larry was on the phone, and I was trying to answer, and all of a sudden, gone.
No Larry?
No.
Larry, we love you. It's not us.
Try calling again, Larry.
Try again, please. While he's doing that, I will tell you, I finished reading all 9 books of The Expanse.
Aha.
Wonderful.
Yep.
Wonderful. I've been telling people this for a month now. Most series, you get somewhere in the middle and they lag. You know, they kind of sag in the middle. Not this one.
Mm-hmm.
Not one single book was okay, I can wait for another one. But I didn't enjoy this one as much. Every single one was excellent.
Good.
Excellent.
They've started a new series, and I swore I wouldn't read the first one until all 3 are out.
Yeah.
But I broke down and read the first one, and now I've got to wait 2 years for the next one.
yep. James S.A. Corey is the pen name of Ty Frank, and now I forget the other guy's name.
Daniel something, I think.
Daniel something. Yeah. But at any rate, there are two authors who write science fiction, and if you're a science fiction... this is hard science. This is proper space opera, the way it should be done.
It was sold to Sci-Fi Channel and then went to Amazon for a couple of seasons.
Yeah, it's five seasons altogether, I think.
It was. It's been praised as one of the best science fiction, real science series. I love the fight scenes when the bullets go through the ship.
Don't tell me you haven't seen it yet.
Well, it's the when you die in space, you don't fall over backwards.
Right.
You just stop moving.
Right, exactly.
But apparently one of the reasons why it's such a rich environment is it started out as an RPG, a role-playing game. And so they wrote all this backstory for the game.
That makes so much sense.
And then it's not a game.
Apparently
somebody said, you know, you should make that a TV show, not a game. And they said...
That makes so much sense.
Okay, let's find it.
So they wrote the books. And the other series I really like is Killjoys.
Yeah.
That was excellent. All right. Enough of that nonsense. To the phone, our first caller is Larry from Rochester, New York, who did indeed call us back. Thank you for persisting, Larry.
That's all right. Thank you, guys. How are you today?
Peachy. Yourself?
Good. Doing well. I just wanted to say I got a scam bill from PayPal yesterday for a huge amount of money. And so I actually went to my PayPal account to make certain everything was okay there. But I was just floored by the authenticity of this thing.
It probably was real. It was really from PayPal. So PayPal has a service. If you have a company, you can bill people for your services. And so bad guys have found that out, and so they send you a fake bill. But it really comes from PayPal. So half of the things we say about determining if an email is a scam or not don't work, because this is a real message, really from PayPal. The contents of the message are wrong and fake. And they always ask for some ridiculously outrageous fee. If they said $20, $30, $40, they'd probably catch a lot more people. But yes, it's very hard now because the messages are really coming from PayPal.
This was over $500, and I know I haven't made a charge like that. And
yeah,
so,
right.
So you stop and think. That's the problem is you stopped and thunk.
Yeah, exactly.
They try to catch people not to think.
Panic.
Yeah, panic about, I better pay.
And you did the right thing, Larry. You went to PayPal. You went to your PayPal account, not clicking on a link in an email or any of that nonsense. You actually went to your real PayPal account.
Right. But as I said, I was just floored by the authenticity of it. I kept looking at it, and I said, I know my wife didn't do it. I know I didn't do it, and we're the only two that could.
Right.
And so I went to PayPal, and I went through everything.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I decided, this is stuff. This ain't even real, and I deleted it. But I have to admit, for a moment, I was shocked because of the dollar amount. And I'm thinking, did PayPal get something wrong? Or what?
So, no, it doesn't take much to create something like that and then send it out a million times.
It used to be worth their effort. It used to be the bad guys had to send individual bills to each person. And so you get a fake bill as a Word file, here's the invoice for the service or whatever.
Yeah.
And now they're using PayPal to disintermediate.
Right.
So you can automate it. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And you can automate it, and it's a level of anonymity to help hide the bad guys.
But you're telling me that PayPal actually sent that?
Is probably.
They may have.
Yeah.
It may not have been them, but it is conceivable that it could have been them.
So
as Steve said, there is a service where I, as a business, could bill anybody through PayPal.
So I sell something on my website, and I send you a bill from PayPal. And then you click on the pay link, and it pays it. So it's very, very common now for small businesses who don't want to have to run their own e-commerce program.
Right. Well, I didn't recognize the so-called business. I kept looking at this and the little logo and everything, and I said, we haven't done anything like that. But, I was really tempted to get click happy. Then I had to slow myself down and say, wait a minute.
Good for you.
Yep.
I didn't do it. Let me go through the steps. And
good.
At that time, I just determined this is not right. This is somebody trying to get my money.
Well done, Larry.
All right. As usual, I learned something new every time when you said that PayPal actually probably sent it. That's news to me. But I balled my fist up, sat there and looked and went through it slowly and methodically.
Yes.
So,
good. Well done. That was exactly the right thing to do. You did the right thing, Larry.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
As usual in your experience.
Have fun.
Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports both have big articles on this type of fraud because it targets old people who may not know what PayPal is anyway.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. See you in a few.
computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 34 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. And we have Fred from Rochester, New York on the line. Hey, Fred, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to piggyback off of Larry's call. I think Larry and I may have gotten the same email.
Really?
There's been a surge of of this PayPal scam.
So this is definitely not from PayPal. It is actually a JPEG. They've got the PayPal logo pasted onto a page. It's one of the first hints is that it's from a Gmail account of somebody that I do not know.
Yep.
It's a Gmail account with a username of HHGHG8FH.
They don't even bother trying. They don't need to bother trying. People never look.
Yeah.
And it says, you know, if this is not you, call this number, which is definitely phishing. And before I delete it, I report it as phishing.
Yep.
Via the Gmail option with the three dots. You have to open the email before you can do that. And generally you have to do it on a computer, not your phone.
Right.
But I report every one of them as phishing to the degree that most of these that come like this actually go straight to my spam folder anyway.
Yep.
But I look at the spam folder to see, just glance down through there, maybe something in there that went by mistake.
Yep.
But definitely, you know, it's not from PayPal. I've never had any, even an attempt of scam that shows up as a PayPal charge. So I go to my PayPal and I look at what. So I kind of do a whole ritual in the morning of going through my accounts and just glancing down at the charges.
Good for you.
They're all ones that I know. I may not look at the specific amount, but it's just this place, that place, and the third that I do business with and have made a recent purchase. And, you know, there's never anything there at PayPal. It's always just a phishing scam.
Yep.
trying to get me to call. Early on, probably a couple of years ago now, before we had this conversation about phishing, I did call the number once upon a time, and the first thing they wanted me to do was to give them access to my device.
Of course.
And I go on, oh, hell no.
Yep.
If you put a charge through, which, you know, may well try, I said, I will report you as fraud to the bank, and that'll be the end of that. But, yeah, so, yeah, right on, Larry, for bringing that to your attention, bringing it to everybody's attention. Right on to all you at Sound Bites for making us aware of, you know, what not to do.
Yep. Thank you, Fred. Yeah. And well done, you, too.
Appreciate it.
Good.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Have fun. Thanks.
Bye.
We had a customer bring a machine in that got an email from Microsoft Canada.
Soundbite, your name?
The email said it was from live.ca.
Soundbite, your name?
It wasn't. But the link it posted was, hello, was some weird thing or other. And when in a sandbox, I click it, and that domain is gone.
Right.
So from the morning where they clicked the link and answered whatever the fake questions were till a couple hours later when they brought it in, that fraudulent website has been found and removed. But I look it up. The domain name was registered 3 days ago in Iceland. In Reykjavik. And the address they used is the Museum of Phallic Objects.
Oh, very, very nice.
In downtown Reykjavik. So if you're ever in downtown Reykjavik.
Yeah.
But they were using, it was registered through Namecheap, which uses privacy hiding. Remember when Whois used to tell you everything and then people got mad that it told you everything? Because bad guys started using it to stalk you. So now it had a privacy, your, what was the name of it? Your name withheld. So then I start Googling around, and I found an article in the New York Times about this new scam from Reykjavik, from the company named Your Name Withheld.
Oh, boy.
Not even realizing that's how every website domain right. that sells privacy protection,
right?
Your Name Withheld.
That's hysterical. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is our friend Scott from Buffalo, New York. What's up, Scott?
Well, I heard your discussion about science fiction earlier.
Yes.
And I am in book 6 of a series called Not Alone. Book 1 blew me away. That's enough that I've given away several copies to friends.
What was the name of it?
Not Alone. By Craig Faulkner.
Ten book series, it says. Oh, I just saw an ad for this in my feed. With a giant spaceship crashing into the ocean. Aliens exist. The government knows. And Dan McCarthy just found the proof.
Nice.
Add to cart.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I'll be looking that up.
The realism in book one of how the world reacts to this idea of an alien is really rather amazing. So I appreciate it quite a bit.
Yep.
All right. Thank you. Perfect.
Yeah. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And that's a, 10-book series?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nice. I'll post that. So on Security Now, one of the Steve Gibson is a sci-fi fan, so they talk about books and Neal Stephenson, and they went through the Expanse books. So Steve one day, testing out ChatGPT, asked it, you know, I like Neal Stephenson books, what else should I read? And it gave him a list of 10 authors, 6 of them he'd already read.
Right.
But one of them he found was Neil Asher, who is a British science fiction author. And he got a couple of Asher books. And they're wonderful. He did say they're not available on Kindle Unlimited, so I actually had to pay for each book, but I'm glad I did.
I will look up this Not Alone series. I have to find somebody to cleanse my palate after 9 hardcore science fiction books. I got to find something to cleanse my palate. I did find there's a series of comedy books that I might pick up. Or I might just go back and reread Discworld. What it annoys me when somebody says, this: if you love Discworld, you'll love this series. You know, there aren't a lot of Terry Pratchett's out there.
Mm-hmm.
You may be good, but you aren't Terry Pratchett good. We find there is an interesting corollary between people who read fantasy and science fiction and do computer stuff. And I'm not entirely sure. And who do music.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of it was we read this science fiction as a kid. We grew up wanting that thing. So we made it. That's the Star Trek flip phone. That's why the first cell phones were flip phones. What was his name? Not Vint Cerf. He was internet. They came right out and said, I made the flip phone because of Captain Kirk.
Yep, that's exactly right. And one of the things that amuses me greatly is the pie hole. We've talked about the pie hole.
Mm-hmm.
You put it on your network and it blocks ads and stuff. And it's got a web interface. And you get to choose the interface, light or dark or different colors. One of them is LCARS.
Yep.
Which is the
Library Computer Retrieval Access System.
Something like that. Yeah. The Star Trek computers, the way they looked.
Yeah.
It's called LCARS, LCARS.
Oh.
And you just click a button and suddenly you're in Star Trek. It's clearly somebody just, you know.
Hey, Star Trekkie.
They decided this is what we had to have. And now we're starting to see graphical user interfaces that look like the TVA stuff from the Loki series.
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting to see those types of interfaces. That's all orange screen text, but we can, you know, we're seeing people doing it.
Okay.
Because, you know, they really wanted to recreate that look. And, of course, you can get screensavers that are the Matrix, that those green letters.
Yeah, letters coming down.
Most of those were Japanese characters that don't make any sense when they're translated.
Right. But
it was a cool effect.
Yeah.
Very cool effect. And so, you know, we see a lot of that, and people recreate that stuff fairly quickly and fairly consistently whenever they like the look of something in a TV show or a movie or whatever. I was pretty impressed by some of that stuff. But we might as well read a little Microsoft news while we're here. Microsoft analysts, it's all the same. Okay. Microsoft analysts have detected a sharp rise in activity involving the dangerous Luma Stealer, Info Stealer. This malware is used by cyber criminals worldwide. The platform enables customers to create their own virus variants, manage stolen data, and select command and control channels. So what's being sold to the bad guys is a turnkey system for doing all of this stuff. You don't even have to be good at it anymore. Criminals use sophisticated delivery methods, including phishing emails, like, for example, the PayPal thing, fake updates, infected websites, and legitimate cloud services. This malware steals data from Chrome, Chrome, Mozilla, and Edge browsers, including passwords, cookies, plugins that steal from the clipboard. It evades detection through deep obfuscation, injection into system processes, and technologies such as Heaven's Gate or low-level syscall. This threat can be completely eliminated only with enhanced multi-level defense, including multi-factor authentication, which we tell everybody to do all the time, blocking scripts and using secure browsers. At the Build 2025 Developer Conference, Microsoft announced a new advanced settings feature to help users and developers personalize the OS experience. With advanced settings, you can customize several features of Windows 11, such as the File Explorer and virtual machines. The new advanced settings page can be accessed from Settings System Advanced. Duh. It replaces the For Developers tab in the settings and retains all of its features. Signal Messenger is warning users of its Windows desktop version that the privacy of their messages is under threat by recall. The AI tool rolled out in Windows 11 that will screenshot, index, and store almost everything a user does every 3 seconds. You'd better have a lot of storage and not do anything that you don't want posted publicly. Effective immediately, Signal for Windows will default block the ability of Windows to screenshot the app. Signal users who want to disable the block, for instance, to preserve a conversation for their records or make the use of accessibility features for the site impaired, will have to change the settings inside their desktop version to enable screenshots. Look, there's nothing secret here, so give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415.
There's been a lot of talk about the Microsoft recall feature when it was first announced in beta. Hey, wouldn't it be neat if you could just ask your computer what that thing was you looked at 3 weeks ago? And then someone answered back, yeah, hi, I'm a bad guy. What was that thing he looked at his bank 3 weeks ago?
Yep, that's exactly right.
The first implementation had virtually no security involved. The database was unencrypted while you were logged in. It used your login password. They have made some improvements on that. And so now it's basically safe-ish unless you already have a threat on your computer. Which, okay, you've got a threat on your computer, nothing is safe.
Right.
But how much extra space do you want it to take up? They say it won't take much. Yeah, right.
How do you take a screenshot every 3 seconds and not use a lot of space?
Compression.
I don't care how much you compress it. After a year, you've got a lot of screenshots on your system.
Yep. Then maybe they do a diff. You haven't changed much in 3 seconds.
Yeah, maybe.
But fortunately for most people, I think right now it needs a higher end processor, and so not everyone gets it.
Right. But they're making it default in Windows 11 now.
Yeah.
So if you're running Windows 11, you will get it. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Ken from Rochester, New York. What's up, Ken?
Hi, fellas. How are you doing today?
Peachy, how are you?
I'm trying to do be peachy, but I've got a little bit of a problem, and I have a hunch. I think I know what it is, but I wanted the expert's opinion.
But instead, you called us.
Yeah.
Well, no, I actually think of you guys as the expert. I know you're just funny.
Yeah.
Years ago, I went to college, and I bought a PC specifically to take some computer courses.
Sure.
And used it, and it's an oldie but a goodie with Windows 7, and it's pristine. Like, I just pulled it out today out of the box. Turned it on. I've got the fan going. Looks like almost wonder if the power supply is screwed up here.
What, do you get an error message?
What's coming up on the screen?
Oh, okay. Let's start at the beginning then. I get no screen. Mm-hmm. I get no mouse. I get the fan on the CPU cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the fan on the back of the power supply, I could feel air coming out.
Yeah.
I can see on the back of this model, it's a compact, by the way. It's got a green light near the power supply.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Presario CQ5320F.
Okay.
And I'm getting no. What's concerning me now is I've got no screen at all. And I know this is a good monitor. I tested it on another system.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no keyboard and no mouse.
One thing I would suggest you do is if you can take the cover off the side.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can put your hand in where the hard drive is, and when you're turning it on, feel if you put your hand there, and when you turn it the computer on, you should hear or feel vibrations coming from that hard drive as it's winding up.
Okay, let me do that.
Because if it's not winding up, that's why you're not getting anything on the screen, because it's not posting.
Ah, okay, hold on. I just turned it off by the actual switch, by holding it in. I'm going to turn it back on.
Does the computer have more than one video port by any chance? I know some of them will have an inline port and then a slot for the video.
Yeah, if a video card versus onboard. Yeah.
And if you have the monitor plugged into the wrong port.
No, unfortunately. Well, actually, in this case, it's fortunate, right? There's only one place to put it. It's VGA.
Yeah. Okay, it's on the back, yep.
And it's going to a good no monitor. I've already tested it. An oldie but a goodie.
Okay.
From my early days. A Wang color 14-inch monitor.
Wow.
I can feel vibrations coming from the drive, Dave.
What's the maximum resolution of the monitor? Maybe it's too low for the minimum resolution of the computer.
Or did it work before and now it's not?
Well, basically it's been sitting for quite a few years. Untouched. Now,
dead CMOS battery.
Well, that was going to be my suggestion. Is go into the BIOS when you boot up. I don't know what the
but
key
he's saying he's
is.
Not getting anything on the screen. So that's why I'm wondering. It's not posted. In other words, he's not even getting the initial screen that you'd hit like delete or F11 or that to get into the BIOS.
Yeah. That's true.
So if it's been sitting a long time, it's possible that the internal battery, sometimes it's a 2032 button cell, sometimes it's a 1/2 AA barrel cell that maintains the computer settings when it's powered off. If that battery is too low, it may not be able to load its default settings and even turn on at all. I've run into a lot of PCs that do that.
Well,
so pull that out and try a battery tester on it at least.
You know, I won't do that. I have brand new batteries for this, and it is a 2032. Mm-hmm. Just happens that I was troubleshooting another PC that I have here that had a problem. And, of course, it was the battery went dead, but it gave me that information on the monitor. So I can easily – I've got this side case off, so, I mean, doing all this is easy enough. And I'm just troubleshooting it with my peripherals plugged in here just to see what's happening. So that would – listen. You'll make my day if all it is the battery. My biggest concern was maybe a surge hit it along the way somewhere and But why would it power up, though? That's kind of odd.
Oh, yeah. No, power supply doesn't know any different. It's it just, that's all it does is turn it on, and it supplies electricity to its various sources, whether it's the, well, it's already doing part of its job. It's spinning up the hard drive. It's, you know, turning the things on so that you, do you get any beeps?
Very minor. One beep when it powers up.
Okay, that's that's an indication that it's trying to start.
Power supplies are generally pretty robust with giant capacitors in them, but the tiny integrated circuits on the logic board are often more more vulnerable to surges. So it's, so that is possible.
A capacitor that could have popped?
Yeah. Yeah, if you look at the capacitors, see if any of them have, are swollen or popped.
Oh, I can...
Yeah, on the motherboard, you can look around and see. They're usually, it looks like the tops of them have a, either like a K. And if they've popped, they'll swell up and you'll see stuff maybe leaking out from that or just swollen. They should be flat, but if they're, you know, bad, they'll swell right on up. They mushroom.
Remember the capacitor plague was over 25 years ago now?
Yeah. Oh, I remember that one.
His computer is 25 years old.
Yeah, I'm looking at the board. I'm telling you, fellas, it's looks like I just pulled it out of the box, ready to put it in the machine. I mean, obviously, it came built into it. And I see absolutely no damage anywhere.
Okay, so a couple other things that I would suggest you try, in addition to the, all the other things we've talked about, make sure all your connections are in tight.
At both ends.
Playing around in the closet and moved back and forth and banged and knocked over, and you know, it, cables could work loose. So check all the cables inside the machine. Make sure each of them is tight. If it, one thing I might try is pulling out the hard drive, testing it on another machine. You can get a carrier, a USB carrier for a hard drive. That, you know, is either SATA or whatever connector it has, and then plug it in USB to another machine as it looks like a thumb drive now to that machine. And that will at least give you some idea of whether or not the drive itself is good.
Yeah, you're testing basically the various components.
Yep. Troubleshooting.
Right.
You're on the same mindset. I get it. And, you have to help me with this drive. I'm an oldie.
Yeah, so
I don't normally deal with SATA, but in this drive, what I've got,
that should be IDE.
It's a according to the specs, it's an ATA.
Yeah, so it's parallel ATA. It's a PETA drive, and then we moved into serial ATA drives, the current SATA drives. So you just need you need a different connector with the PETA connection on it.
Right, you should still be able to buy one like at Amazon. Carrier with a
lot of times you get ones with both.
Yeah.
The device you're describing to do troubleshooting with a multitude of drives where they have the plugs all the way around, I do have that. So that's not a problem. USB. But on this particular drive, what's confusing to me is unlike the old ATAs, they only had two plugs, one solid. I see the two plugs for the drive itself because I've dealt with SATA before. But off to the right, looking at the back of the drive, there is 8 pins, and it's in a square box. And I see
jumpers.
Jumpers.
Yeah, those are the old jumpers.
Wow.
To set master slave.
Yeah.
Well, primary and secondary.
Secondary.
So written on the drive itself is often the jumper settings for whether it's a primary drive, single drive, or secondary drive.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I got to assume nothing's changed with that because there's only one drive. It was set to, you know,
Yeah, so probably set to single drive.
Yeah, it was set to the master, and it's been working, but... No, I took stop using it after college. And
well, you've got some things to try now, Ken. So.
Yeah. I will give it a whirl, and thank you for all your information and expertise.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, and with that, the first hour of this show is history, but do not despair. There's an entire another hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe coming your way. another hour of Dave Enright, another hour of Steve Ray, another hour of me, Nick Francesco, and another hour of you, but only if you give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Go out and get yourself a little snack, maybe a beverage. Take a bio break. I know we're going to do that. But we'll be back in just a few minutes with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. And you already know that that would be Sound Bites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
This is 90.1 WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District and official media partner of this year's Rochester International Jazz Festival. Jazz 90.1.
Streaming online at jazz901.org.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we are hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. And, of course, you can give it. We have anybody on the line?
Nope.
Nope. You can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. And I'll read the security news. Google has announced a new feature in its Chrome browser that lets its built-in password manager automatically change a user's password when it detects the credentials have been compromised. The feature builds upon Password Manager's existing capabilities to generate strong passwords during sign-up and flag credentials that have been detected in a data breach. Threat actors have been distributing Trojanized versions of the KeePass password manager for at least 8 months, to install Cobalt Strike beacons, steal credentials, and ultimately deploy ransomware on the breach network. As KeePass is open source, the threat actors altered the source code to build a Trojanized version of Key Loader that contains all the normal password management functionality. Mozilla released emergency security updates to address two Firefox zero-day vulnerabilities demonstrated in the recent Pwn2Own Berlin 2025 hacking competition. The fixes, which include the Firefox on desktop and Android and two extended support releases, came mere hours after the conclusion of Pwn2Own, where the second vulnerability was demonstrated. Speaking of which, the Pwn2Own Berlin 2025 hacking competition is concluded, with security researchers earning $1,780,750 after exploiting 29 zero-day vulnerabilities and encountering some bug collisions. Throughout the contest, they targeted enterprise technologies in the AI, web browser, virtualization, local privilege escalation, servers, environment applications, cloud native container, and automotive categories. A Google Chrome Web Store campaign uses over 100 malicious browser extensions that mimic legitimate tools such as VPNs, AI assistants, and crypto utilities to steal browser cookies and execute remote scripts secretly. The extensions offer some of the promised functionality, but also connect to the threat actor's infrastructure to steal user information or receive commands to execute. Additionally, the malicious Chrome extensions can modify network traffic to deliver ads, perform redirections, or proxying. Although Google removed many of the extensions, domain tools identified, some of them remain on the Chrome Web Store. So be careful what you install. In good security news, police in Europe, South America, Asia, and the United States arrested 270 suspects following an international law enforcement action codenamed Operation Raptor that targeted dark web vendors and customers from 10 countries. They also seized over $207 million in cash and cryptocurrency, more than 2 metric tons of drugs, including amphetamines, cocaine, ketamine, opioids, and cannabis, and over 180 firearms. Up your security and give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. I have to say, I do love Pwn to Own. It's it's a great competition. Basically, what they do is they get ethical hackers, people who are mostly cybersecurity experts, and they give them rewards for breaking into computers. The trick, of course, is that you have to tell them what you did so that they can fix it.
One of the criticisms I've heard, criticism might be too strong a word, if you find a bug in a program, you tell the company and they can fix it. And a lot of companies have their own bug bounty programs that pay you along the way. In fact, if you're good enough, you can make a living just finding bugs.
Yep.
But as it gets close to one of the Pwn to Own competitions, and there's a half a dozen around the world every year, we hear people are holding back the bugs so they can exploit them at Pwn to Own to win the bigger prizes.
Right.
So that means people are left vulnerable longer before the bug is found and fixed. So I don't quite know how I feel about that.
Yeah, there is a window.
Yeah.
There is a window, but it's no longer than the monthly window Microsoft gives you.
Yeah.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Chuck from Penfield, New York. What's up, Chuck?
Hi, guys. You mentioned something a little earlier that kind of raised a question I've always had. Could you explain to me open source? I understand kind of what it is, but who owns the source? Who compiles and distributes the code? Different compilers, depending on what your switch settings are, can generate slightly different code. Who verifies and tests? You know what I'm saying? What's involved here?
All right, so open source, for those who don't know, open source generally is one of two things. Well, open source itself means that you can see the code. Often it also means that it is free. So there's two types of free, right? There's the free to see what's in the code and free to use it yourself. So open source is one of those two things, often both. As to who owns it, well, it is nominally owned by the person who wrote the code. But they have put it often in the public domain, which means that anyone can download and use it.
Or if it's not in the public domain, it's in like Creative Commons.
It's in the Creative Commons.
So you're allowed to look at it, you're allowed to use it, but you can't change it. Although there is another...
Well, it depends on which Creative Commons license you use.
There's another Creative Commons license that says you can change it, and that's called forking. So right. That's why we have...
You can do anything you want with it, or you can use it as long as you attribute me to having written it.
That's why we have OpenOffice, Apache Office, LibreOffice. They're all forks of the open source base code.
Who is responsible for the coding, testing...
The people who wrote it. The people who wrote it. So, for example...
But you're sounding like that can be anybody.
Yes, it could.
It is. You can write a program and make the code open source so that anyone can read your code.
So, for example, let's say you use Ubuntu, which is an open source operating system.
Well, you can have an open source program, open source OSs.
Right.
Yeah.
So you would be able to say, okay, I want to download the Linux code and use it myself.
And
there are dozens, if not hundreds, of people behind Linux who wrote that code, maintain that code, make sure that code compiles correctly, distributes that code online, but gives it away for free.
And oftentimes...
So you have hundreds of different versions and hundreds of different people responsible for...
So there's dozens of people who work on Ubuntu.
Okay.
But Ubuntu is a fork of Debian, the original Debian from Ian and Deb. Deb and Ian Debian.
Yeah, okay.
I forget their last name.
Yeah.
And they created Debian, and Ubuntu said, okay, we're going to take the open source Debian and add some things and change some things and make it Ubuntu. Somebody else took the open source Debian and said, we're going to add some things and change some things and make it, you know, a different version of Linux.
And it's usually the programmer says, I want this feature to do this, and it doesn't do it already, so they write it.
Right. Or you know what? I really like this operating system, but boy, I wish they added these two features.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other
thing. So I make a fork that does those two features.
Would it become a Wild West then? Or
No.
Well, yes.
Well, let's back up for a second, too. Being open source, these other folks, you know, as you're using the program, could say, hey, you know, I would also like to see this feature added onto it. And they can work on that part of the program and submit it to the programmers and say, hey, you know what? I wrote this. See what you think. You know, here's some another feature that I think would be a great add-on to your program. And they can pull that in to make sure that it's going to work well.
And test it and everything else
most
before
large,
they add it.
Most large open source projects will have a manager that manages all of the individual code. But that's for the larger projects. If you want to write your own program, you can release the source code yourself. And it's open source for a program
that you wrote. But if I'm an individual that wants to use one of these open source products, how do I know which one I'm getting, who's responsible for it, whether it's been thoroughly tested, and you know I'm not going to get a piece of
that? All comes from the project manager,
right? Okay. So here's the thing: a lot of this stuff is available on a system called GitHub. So when you read about some piece of software you might like, and they give you a link to GitHub, you go to GitHub, and the first thing you see is a list of all the files and the last time they were updated. If you see something that hasn't been updated in 3 years, move on. But if you see something that had an update last week, that's probably a well-maintained piece of software, and you can give it a try.
Or in the past few months.
Right. So the other thing is, how secure is that? Well, that's a very good question. You look around the web and you see who else has used it and what they think, and you'll often find that some security analyst has taken a look at that piece of software and decided whether or not it is good. And then, you know, when you're looking at something like Ubuntu, Debian, Red Hat, one of those operating systems, Linux Mint, any of those, you can be pretty sure that they've done a good job vetting all the code that's in them, and they're clean.
And that's why we also recommend it. If you've got an old machine sitting around, do it on that. Do not do it on your main machine, you know, other than, you know, if you don't mind monkeying around and having it maybe burn up on you, you know, because of bad code or whatever. Always do it on an experimental machine because, you know, you can buy, or if you have one of the old, like the gentleman that called before, had the old Windows 7 machine. You know, you could put Windows Ubuntu on that, and it would probably run just as fast as it would on Windows 10 or 11 right now.
Faster.
So, you know, I mean, I wouldn't put it, go around playing with it on my main machine.
But so to answer your question, it depends. It depends on if it's a big project or a small project. Big projects often have dozens of people and people who are lined up to become part of that project. So there are people who, you know, send stuff in to Linus Torvalds, who is the maintainer of the Linux root code. All the time, and he tests it and rejects a lot of it and accepts some of it, and people he's accepted 15, 20, 30 times, he then calls them up and says, hey, how would you like to be part of our team?
Now, do they do the testing?
Yes.
Because you know how software is. You fix one thing and three other things break. So you
exactly.
Right.
And you know what?
Testing.
Often enough, open source software is better tested and better maintained than the commercial packages because they have more eyes on it, and those people are doing it as a labor of love, not as a 9-to-5 job.
Okay.
And many times for the biggest projects, they will have third-party code testers.
Okay.
But every now and then, there was just something found in the TCP stack after 20 years.
Yeah.
It was wrong. And so TCP is the original specification. somebody found a problem 20 years later, mostly because computers are so much faster now.
Right, right.
And that gets fixed.
Okay, okay. Okay, I was, it always puzzled me, if it's open source, who can get at it, who can do it, who can, you know, where does it come from, who's responsible?
It's an almost an offshoot of shareware.
Yeah.
I write a program, I let people use the program, and they give me money if they want to.
Right.
Right.
The, you know, below that is the code that made that program. If I want other people to be able to help my program, I can make the code open source so that other people can look at it and help make my code better.
Okay, okay. All righty.
There you go.
Thanks for the education.
Sure, Chuck. Okay, thank you for calling. Yep, bye-bye.
Then there's that XKCD comic about all the modern digital infrastructure and these thousands of projects are resting on a tiny little random person in Nebraska. That one person has been like FFmpeg or...
Right.
One person way down there at the bottom is working on this thing, and when he decides to retire...
Well, that happened to Dave with a piece of software that yep. he bought. He bought it. It wasn't even open source. The person who was writing it retired, and
yep.
now, it, you know, too bad. Now find something else. So I get that. It's, you know, you don't have any... more or less chance of that happening to you in open source.
Yeah.
You actually have less chance in open source. Because if it's open source and a lot of people like it, somebody's going to pick it up.
Yeah.
You know, it's not... It open source software rarely dies. It may transform, but it rarely dies. All right, our next caller is Brian from Rochester, New York. What's up, Brian?
Oh, the sky is getting a little brighter, so the clouds are up, I guess.
There you go.
That's a good thing. Now, this is a fairly simple question. I'm sure you'll dismiss me in mere look at the wrist. I watch you guys on YouTube, which is very nice. Of course, now I've got Chrome running in the background. It's a Chrome machine. And popped up in the right-hand corner, every once in a while, free up space to continue. Some features on docs.google.com might not work until you clear data, okay? On your device. And then there's a little blue bar at the bottom that says, choose sites to clear. Okay. I click on that, and it goes to privacy and security, and I have this huge list of programs. Some I recognize, some I don't, but they're all cookies. Mm-hmm. Now, how do I know which cookies are worthwhile saving, or just delete them all and start over again?
Well, it doesn't hurt to delete many of them. It depends on what you're deleting. So you want to keep the obvious ones, like your bank.
But a lot of times you can't tell where the cookie came from because it's random. No, it's a random string.
Right, right, right. Well, but in Chrome, it will tell you what site gave you that cookie. So go ahead.
The first one on the list is Google.com, 60 cookies.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're going to get those whether you delete them, they'll come back again in 4 minutes. So
those were all your search queries. Yeah, so when you start typing a search, it can look through your search history and maybe you're searching for the same thing again.
Right.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if you dump those. The ones you want to keep are the places. Well, except the ones you want to keep are the places you sign into. Right. Okay. So your bank and you know Gmail and like those, they can be useful to keep. The ones from like a shopping site or that sort of fair, or a news site or some random place you went where you don't sign in or don't care about the sign in, dump them.
All right. Yeah, that's kind of what I thought.
But because that's such a pain to go through all those cookies and do that, most people just clear them all.
Clear them all and start over.
And they'll start over again, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And that means you will have to log into some sites that you may not have had to log into for a while.
Because the cookie is remembering your session.
Right.
Right. But most of the ones that I would do in that are two-factor identification anyway.
Right, right, right. So there you go. So, just dump your cookies. You can, aside from what we just said about places you log in, there's no harm in dumping your cookies.
The bigger question, in my mind, is why is your disk so full that your cookies that it's telling you to delete your cookies?
Well, he's got a Chromebook, so there's only a limited amount of storage to begin with.
782 megabytes of cookies.
Yeah, exactly. So, which on a terabyte drive is nothing.
Yeah.
But on a Chromebook is a lot.
Yeah.
So yeah, go ahead and dump them. It's not going to hurt anything. The real problem is that most of the it's lazy programmers, right? Programmers, you can say part of the cookie specification is how long does this cookie live before it dies? Most people just say forever. The hell with it.
Yep. Forever, right? Yeah.
And in most cases, individual cookies are tiny. But then you start getting thousands and thousands of them, and they add
thousands
up quick.
Of them.
Yeah.
Real quick, right.
Right.
A different question, real quick. Two-factor identification.
Yep.
Some of the ones that I have to go to are work-related or more secure things like my bank. I didn't set up two-factor identification. They gave it to me and said, you've got to do it this way. You've got to sign in, and we'll send you the code, and you've got to sign that in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's not always that you have to set it up. Somebody sets it up for you and say, you want to talk to us? Two-factor.
Right.
Yeah. Most companies these days, when you make a new login, will require two-factor. For the longest time, that wasn't an issue, and that's why we have problems now. Trying to add two-factor to those old sites. But we're also seeing now many sites are pushing passkeys. Every time I go to a Google site, it's use your passkey. No, because I have 17 different computers on 100 different accounts. So the big problem with passwords is the other end has to keep a secret, and they're very bad at that. There's literally billions and billions and billions of lost passwords. So they started doing two-factor. So if somebody gets your password, now you have to put a code in your cell phone as a text message. Mm. But text messaging isn't very secure. And if you're a valuable enough target, they'll get your text messages. Or there's human factors. The bad guy says, "Hi, I'm Apple. We're going to send you a code to make sure it's you." As the bad guy is breaking into your account. Or Google or Microsoft or whoever.
That's why a lot of places are using authenticators now.
Right. Microsoft is shutting down their authenticator app. Yeah. So if you're using Microsoft's authenticator, stop and get a new one now. But that's also a little annoying because there were several authenticator apps. You got to remember which one you used. So Passkeys uses the biometrics in your smartphone, either the fingerprint or the Face ID. And so the website asks your phone, is this really, Joe? And your phone says, show me your face, and then tells the website, yeah, that's Joe. So it's going to be much, much harder to spoof. But not every website supports it yet.
Well, of course.
And they all fall back to, forget your password, I'll send you an email. So when the bad guy gets your email password, they can break into all of your accounts anyway.
Yeah, but two-factor authentication, 2FA, as you'll see it written, is way better than one factor.
Yeah, the one factor being your password, yeah.
Right. Well, it's just a one way of skipping over one thing and getting caught with the next thing.
Exactly right.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I'll let you get back to people who really need your help.
All right. Thanks, Brian.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Bye.
I've heard stories on mostly Security Now where someone says, I never bother remembering my password. If I want to log in again, I say forgot. They send me an email, and I'm in. So okay, you don't even know your password. I guess that's okay. But it also means that when you're trying to log in and you don't have your email handy, that's going to be a problem.
I had that just the other day. I was trying to log into a site that someone else had set up, and the second factor was their phone number.
Yeah.
So I had to call them and say, you're about to get a code.
Yep.
Give me the code.
We see that all the time, husband and wife.
Yeah.
One will bring in the computer and the code is in the other one's phone.
Yeah. But
they haven't updated their 2FA phone number, and it's the landline they had 20 years ago. Everybody, if you use two-factor codes, make sure you update your phone number.
Yeah, and let me be perfectly clear. What I said to Brian is true. Two factors better than one factor. For all the joking we've done and all the problems we've pointed out, two-factor is still way better than one-factor authentication. It is much, much safer. So anywhere that you can do two-factor authentication in some form, do it. And authenticator is better than text messaging. Text messaging is better than nothing.
And if you have to be currently you have to be a fairly high value target for someone to want to get into your text messages.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But eventually that will become more and more automated and make it easier for the bad guys.
Right. Right now you're right. We could use text messages with mostly impunity. Yeah.
Well, that's why I also encourage folks to use, you know, like the instead of swiping their cards, to use the chip.
Mm-hmm.
Because I explained to them, it's a one-time code. Or, yeah, Apple Pay or any of these others, because they're getting a one-time code, which is far more secure. And they go, oh, really? Mm-hmm. I go, yeah, because when you wipe that strip, that's, you know, so much information that's being fed, more than the system really needs to know, but it's out there, and somebody could hack it and get to it.
Yep. So, yeah, start using the chip. In whichever form you use the chip, if you have it on your phone, that's probably better than having it on the card itself. And if you have it on your watch or your phone, that's good. All right, listen, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe, Sound Bites, and that's right here. On member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you in a couple.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Everybody get up.
You know that's just going to be a YouTube strike.
That's okay.
Yeah, you don't care. He has to do it.
We got
to
talk over it.
All right, welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 34 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites, and we have Fred again from Rochester, New York, on the line. What's up, Fred?
Yeah, your couple callers back had questions about Ubuntu, and it spawned a question that I have looking at a YouTube video. A distro video, forget the exact name of it. They were talking about, the gentleman was talking about, you mentioned Debian, talking about, I have Ubuntu 2404, and the short thing that he said was that you don't need any other outside than what's in your repository with that, with that OS. I do have a few things that came from Debian. Is that safe? Is that...
Yeah, it should be. If they came from one of the reputable things like Debian, Mint, Ubuntu, etc., you should be fine. But the thing you have to... remember is
turn down your radio, please.
Your radio on, Fred.
Yeah, my radio's not on. I'm on my phone.
Oh yeah, okay. So you're getting an echo in there. Technology, you gotta love it because hating it doesn't work. so if you're in terms of your system, if it's in Debian, it should be in Ubuntu. I'm not sure why it wouldn't be in Ubuntu if it's in. If you got it from Debian, the first place to look is always your own repository. Always, always.
Okay.
Only if it's not there should you go to one of the other reputable repositories like Debian or Mint, or you know one of the well-known ones, in order to get something.
Okay. The site was Canonical.
That is Debian. That is Ubuntu.
Yes, I knew that. But one of the things that I found was a driver for an older laptop, thumbprint or fingerprint reader. Actually, it was a 20. It is a 20 something. 2020, I believe, was the date, the newest release of anything, and the Debian one was the one I could most easily install.
Well, okay, so here, okay, so a caveat from what I said earlier to I think Chuck or somebody. When you look for the latest of something, if something works correctly and there hasn't been changed to the hardware, there won't be an update to the software. So right. If a fingerprint reader worked properly in 2020, it's exactly the same hardware, you're going to get the 2020 driver. So that makes sense. Yeah. The
and
other thing 20, is...
It's a 2020 laptop, so...
Right. So the other thing is, in terms of Ubuntu versus Debian, Ubuntu is based on Debian. So in some cases, particularly with things like that where it's a done... It's cooked. It's fully baked.
Yep.
They don't bother to do any sort of updating or even rebranding. They just say, you know what? The Debian one worked. Use that one.
Yeah, there were several that GZ Tar. I couldn't install it. I'm not capable, at this point, experienced enough to get that to work. But the Debian one I clicked on and it works.
Right, because it's not, okay. So what you clicked on was a file that ended in .deb.
Yep.
Yes, that is the Debian packaging system that Ubuntu also uses. So a lot of the packages for Ubuntu are .deb.
They had both, you know.
And the TarGZ is just a way of packaging it for. People who don't use apt. Apt is the package manager underlying the software store, and it uses the .deb files as often as possible. .deb file is designed to just click on it, it installs, and it works. The tar.gz file is something you download, unpack and fiddle with yourself until you get it to work. So where possible, stick with the .deb files.
Okay, all right. They were talking about software too. There's been over the whatever year and change that I've been playing with the Ubuntu. There have been times when I could most easily find a particular software that I heard about either through you or on a YouTube channel. Was most easily installed with the Debian from the Debian package.
Yes, and that's true of most Ubuntu packages. The easiest way to install an Ubuntu package is with the .deb file, and that doesn't mean it's only for Debian. It means it's for Debian-based installers, which is the installer used by Ubuntu.
Yeah, I have the get deb.
Yeah, there you go.
And it just works so easy.
Okay.
I haven't bothered to learn anything else.
You don't need to. You're good.
Okay. So Steve mentions numerous times Security Now.
Yeah.
Where's the best place to look at that?
I will post the website again. It's a podcast, so any podcast catcher. And they also have a YouTube channel and a website.
Is the YouTube channel the same as the rest?
Well, it's on the Twit network, twit.tv.
But yes, it is the podcast, just like our podcast is on YouTube.
Yep.
Okay, because YouTube I get, and the others I don't. I don't have Spotify. I don't have a TV, internet TV.
Right.
Doesn't matter. You can listen to a podcast on your computer or your phone or anything.
Right. You need a podcast. You need podcast software, which you can also find in your repository.
Okay, what about on my phone? What's the best Android phone podcast software?
There are
Google?
probably 100 of them. The one I particularly like
we should be in the
is
Google.
Called Pocket Cast.
Yeah, that's a good one. We're in the Google Podcast directory.
There are literally dozens. Like I said, the one I particularly prefer is Pocket Cast. Okie doke.
Okay. And one last thing that I ran into it. I have Aflac insurance. Aflac on the Google Play device site has an Aflac app that does not work. When I went to Aflac through the website, it says I want to try it on the app. I clicked on that app, and a different app installed that is not recognized by Google Play.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have Aflac. I have not tried that.
Yeah, I just was cautious about using something that was not in Play Store.
And that makes sense. Play Store is pretty well vetted. Yeah. All right, we got to move on, Fred. Right.
Thanks for everything.
All right, thanks. Yeah, generally speaking, if you get something from the website, it's going to be from the actual website of the real company, it's probably okay.
Yeah.
But depending on where they want you to install it from, it may not be as well vetted as it would be in, for example, the Google Play Store.
And it could be that the one directly from Aflac has issues that some programmer decided to write his own version of and post it.
Right. That's always possible. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Judy from Rochester, New York. What's up, Judy?
Well, good afternoon. I would like your opinion on a refurbished Windows computer.
The big issue with refurbished is, why was it refurbished? Did someone have a problem with it and it had to get repaired, or did they just not like it and it was returned? And you almost never know that. So if the computer had problems and that's why it's refurbished, you don't want it. But if it was just a return that someone decided they didn't like, then it's okay. But unfortunately, you usually have no way of telling that.
The first thing to find out is, where is it coming from, and what is their policy on returns,
and what's their warranty? A lot of times, refurbished computers have like a 90-day warranty.
So, for example, I regularly, and it is an addiction, and I know this. I regularly buy laptops off of Woot.
I got that's where I got my last desktop unit.
Yep. That's where I got my desktop. Well, not this last one, but the two before.
Off of where?
Woot.com. Woot.com.
Which is owned by Amazon, which is probably one of the reasons it's okay.
Yeah, right. But twice now, I have gotten a refurbished computer from them, a laptop, that had a locked BIOS, so I couldn't do anything with it. And they have a 30-day no questions asked return policy. I returned it with no questions asked.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, if you're going to get a refurb, check the return policy, check the warranty, when you get it, take a real good test run with it. Test everything. Okay.
That's good info.
Yeah.
Now the other thing too is make sure what OS it's running. Because Windows 10 support is ending in October, you want to get one with Windows 11.
Yeah. Well, most of them nowadays are coming with 11.
A refurbed is often an older model,
right?
That may still come with 10, and then in what, 5 months, you're screwed because there's no more updates.
Right.
Yeah. No, the one I'm looking at comes with 11, and it also had a one-year warranty.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, that's not bad.
No,
that's not
good.
Bad at all for a refurb.
How much memory in it?
32 gig with a 1 terabyte.
That's good.
That's good.
All right, what chip is in it? What is it, an Intel what? Or
i7.
Yeah.
About what like I got. Yeah, I got an i7.
Yeah, that's a pretty decent setup. When you check the warranty, check the return policy, and when you get it, test it 6 ways from Sunday. Do everything with it that you think you're going to want to do. Test the speakers, test the Wi-Fi, plug something into all of the ports and make sure they all work.
Yeah, run a YouTube video to make sure, you know, the graphics is decent.
Charge it and let the battery run down, see how long that lasts. You know, all the standard things you would do with any refurbished computer, just to make sure before you pass your 30-day window or whatever you got.
All right. Well, that's good information. My second question is, I have a friend who bought a Chinese-made computer.
Yeah?
Well, they all are.
This is like an off-brand of whatever. But when I looked at the reviews on it, first of all, it wasn't for me because it didn't have enough power and memory and everything. But when I looked at the reviews on it, it said that it made a clicking sound when you started it up, plus the sound wasn't good. So I guess my next question is, what is your take on off-brand computers?
Well, an off-brand computer is a crapshoot, and I guess it depends on how lucky you feel. You know, any of the really off-brands are a crapshoot. Certainly, the main names, Lenovo and like that, Asus and what's the other A1? Acer. Asus and Acer are also good, although they're lesser known brands because they're the people who make everybody else's laptops.
Mm-hmm. Put other names on it.
Right. So if you get an Acer or an Asus, you're getting essentially the same computer you get with Dell and Lenovo and everybody else anyway. But when you hit some of the third party brands, and a lot of the third party brands, particularly from China, are suspect right now because some of them have been known to contain spyware.
But they typically sell on shopping channels for really low prices, and that's how they get people in.
Right, right, right.
Part of the problem is then finding someone to work on them. You know, it's pretty easy to find someone to work on a Dell or an HP, but finding some more of the off-party brands, and they can end up being more expensive to repair. So clicking when it starts up and no sound, maybe it needs a new sound card.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's kind of, I'm always skeptical about stuff like that anyway, but I just thought, because we needed to buy a computer, a Windows computer, to run Access. We don't need it for anything else. And she suggested one of these. Computer, I think it was KUU or something like that.
Yeah, I've never heard of them.
A lot of times, a Chromebook or a tablet are all you need for web and email and photos, and you don't need the whole complexity of a full Windows PC.
Right.
Yeah, we know that, but when we asked if we could run the Access database on a Chromebook, they said no.
Yeah. No. If that's your main use, then you do need a Windows machine,
mm-hmm.
or you get somebody to change it from Access to
a Windows VM.
Yeah, or not on a Chromebook.
Well, there's web VMs.
Right, or you get somebody to translate it to SQL Server or something else. I would say that it sounds like you're getting what little you've told us, like you're getting a pretty good deal with your refurbed Windows computer. It sounds like your friend may not have gotten a great deal with the Chinese knockoff.
No, I don't think so either. But I may just check now on the return policy. So thank you very much.
All right. Yep. Good luck.
Thanks.
Thanks. Bye. Yeah, I.
Sometimes there's a reason they're too cheap.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I have to be honest. I some days I cringe when I look at the Woot email. Woot sends me a mail every day. I cringe because when I know if I get to the computer section,
you're addicted.
I'm addicted, and I want another laptop to play with. One of the laptops I've got that's I admit 7 years old. has died.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a hole in my laptop army.
Yeah.
That I would like to fill. I have no reason to fill it. I don't need another laptop. It's like I didn't need my Raspberry Pi 5 that I just bought. It's still in the box.
Yeah, but
I don't need it.
That's backup.
That's backup. That one's backup. But I don't, you know, I don't need another laptop right now. I really don't. Doesn't mean I'm not going to get one. It just means I don't need one.
But wait a minute. I got to back you up here a second.
Yeah.
You got a Raspberry Pi 5.
I did.
And have not even played with it yet?
I have not. I have so much stuff on my plate right now. I have no time for me. Between all the 3D printing I'm doing for my beloved bride and my favorite daughter. Before you call in, she's my only daughter, which makes her my favorite. Although I don't tell her that. I tell her she's in the running. Yeah. she's in the running for my favorite daughter. And the stuff I have to do for Mastermind Lounge and everything else. I'm so busy right now. I just said I finished the 9 book series of The Expanse, but it took me a month and a half to read it. That's ludicrously long amount of time for me. I just have had way too much.
You're getting old, man. Yep.
I've got too much
slowing
on my plate.
Down. You're slowing down.
I have to learn to say
no. That's not in your bed.
I can't do it. I can't do it.
But a Raspberry.
You got to figure out how to.
Five.
I got a Pi 5. Yeah.
Figure out how to get by in less than 4 hours sleep.
Doesn't sleep much now as it is.
I used to live on 4.5 hours worth of sleep.
Yeah.
I'm now up to 5.5 hours. 5.5 hours every single night. That's another 365 hours a year.
That you could be working on your Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
Raspberry Pi.
Slacker.
Unbelievable. I do. Yeah. I go, it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm tired. I don't get it. I never used to be. I am getting old. I never used to be tired at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
And sometimes I lay abed until 7:30. I hope my wife's not listening. She'd probably say 8:30 at this point. But yeah,
stretching it.
So yeah, I've got my Raspberry Pi sitting on the shelf, ready to do whatever.
Well, you can always just switch the chip out. If you got it just running off of an SD card.
Exactly.
Throw it in just to see the experience of the speed.
The
graphics is supposed to be so much better.
Yeah. It should be much nicer. But the only reason I haven't gotten one
is I've still got an extra 4.
Right.
Because mine are usually running just servers. I've got 3 of them set up as servers. And then I've got another old Raspberry Pi 3 that is what's the best way to describe it? It's just a workstation type of thing that it's a node on what they call this ham radio system. To simplify explanation of it, it's just a node that just sits there and runs 24/7 that people can connect through Raspberry Pi.
Right.
And do that. So I don't need but a 5 just to play around with.
Well, one of mine is running, is a backup machine. And another one is also doing backups, but is also doing surveillance of my network, watching stuff on my network. I'm going to turn one into the one that's just backup. I keep on my list is to turn it into a pie hole. And I don't need a 5 for that. I don't even need a 4 for that.
Yeah.
I could do it with a 3.
Raspberry Pi 0, probably.
Sure. But
zeros are pretty good if they're just going to be like amazing. A dumb terminal.
Yeah.
Because I've got another Pi 0 that is running a what I call DMR. Again, another node for DMR.
Whatever DMR means. R means radio. I know that part.
Yeah, it's a whole other network of connecting sure. with folks and all that.
But at any rate, the thing is, if you're looking at refurbished computers, particularly in this economy, they can be a good buy. But what's most important is to check the warranty, to check the return policy, and to check when you get it, check the system. Like we said to Judy, make it play sound, make it play video, check every one of the ports to make sure they work, and that includes the Ethernet port, as well as Wi-Fi. Make sure all the keys work. You know, very rarely do we use some of the keys. Just go through it and make sure all the keys actually work, including all the alt keys and all the function keys and all the control keys and, you know, everything. Do your due diligence. All right, we are done. And I want to thank Dave Enright, Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. Thanks to everyone who called in. Great stuff this week. We will be back next week with a whole nother two-hour segment of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Be good to one another, will you?